Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who don't know, my name is Howard Dodson. I'm director of the Schomburg Center. It's my pleasure to welcome you this evening for what promises to be a very provocative and insightful, informative forum. I learned of this book about five months ago, and at the time it seemed like a very good idea to do a program around it, and as the months have passed, it's been even more clear to me that it's an appropriate topic around which to have some dialogue discussion. I'll share this with you, which is just me kind of babbling along a little bit. I'm personally concerned, and I hope it's not seen as partisan, but we have a president that's in office in a position that's now under attack. And there's nobody to the left of him to create space for him. You follow what I'm saying? At a public level right now, my biggest concern is that as the the organized opposition of the right continues to push him further and further, or try to push him further and further to the right or off the page completely, there's nobody out front, and so he has to be trotted out every time something has to be answered or defended. And it's not the way to maximize his presence in office. And I say that because some of the responsibility for that is on us. You follow what I'm saying? That if we're not demanding things, creating space over here so that he can have some latitude to move, he's going to get boxed tighter and tighter, and less of what we consider to be our agenda will in fact be on the agenda. It's not my place to be in the discussion in the panel, but it's on my mind, so I'll say it. Insurance companies provide no health care. I'll repeat that. Insurance companies provide no health care. And yet the major discussion around the health care bill is about the future of the insurance companies. And quite frankly, they've won if the bill that was just passed goes through. Because all they've done is authorize through federal mandate that we give more money to the insurance companies. I mean, that's what it is. And there hasn't been enough, in my judgment, organized support for alternatives coming from us. I was in Atlanta several years ago when Maynard Jackson was first elected mayor. And the day after he was elected, I'm walking down the street on Hunter Street, what was then Hunter, now Martin Luther King, and a group of black men are walking down the street, and their conversation went something like this: we've seen what the white dude, meaning the white mayor, has done for us. Now let's see what the black dude's gonna do for us. And guess what? Ain't gonna do no more than you demand. And that's equally true of the president. Now stop there, because I'll be in the middle of the discussion. It's not my place. Out of respect for the authors who are gathered here today, and respect for the real centrality of the topic of race and Barack Obama, I want to take this opportunity to welcome you again to today's program, which is on the new book entitled The Speech, Race and the Barack Obama's More Perfect Union. The book is edited by Deneen Sharpley Whiting, who is here with us, and We want to thank her for collaborating with us in bringing this event together. We also want to thank the contributors to the book who've agreed to join her at this evening's event to share some of their ideas, perspectives on this, what is still fundamental question of the American nation. I know that politically the president has chosen to leave the subject or to dodge the subject for political reasons, but you can't really, in my judgment, deal with what the long-term future of this nation is without dealing with the question of race. There's just no way of doing that. So I think you'll find that some of the presenters here this evening are in agreement with that. It's my understanding that after the program, some of the authors will be available to sign copies of the book, and the books are available in our gift shop. I trust that you will find enough in what is said tonight to want to dig more deeply into the topics and learn more of the content that's provided by the book. Your moderator for this evening is Dr. William Jelani Cobb, associate professor and chair of the history department at Spelman College. He specializes in post-Civil War African American history, 20th century American politics, and the history of the Cold War. He has served as a delegate and historian for the 5th Congressional District at the 2008 National Democratic Convention, and his forthcoming book is In Our Times, Barack Obama and the Meaning of Progress. Please welcome your moderator for the evening, Dr. William Jelani Cobb.
Good evening. How are you all? If I can just have permission to start with a personal note, I am very glad to be here this evening since I'm at Spelman College in Atlanta, but I am a native New Yorker. So when I come back to the Schomburg, it is literally and metaphorically coming home. So I'm very glad to be here this evening, and I'm very glad that we will be able to have what I think will be a enlightening and provocative conversation. So I'll start by providing some context and then introducing our panelists, and then we're just going to jump right into the meat of the discussion. On January 20th, 2009, a black man stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, placed his hand on a Bible held by his wife, and was sworn in by, as President of the United States. Those who were there that day, on the frozen tundra of the National Mall, witnessed nothing less than the passing of an old era and the initiation of another. Those of us born after Martin Luther King took his fateful step on that balcony in Memphis were reared in the seemingly permanent shadow of King's life and the violent way it ended. We took solace in the speech he gave on April 3rd, 1968, the one where he seemed to dip his toe into the waters of his own mortality, as if he knew that somehow he'd be fully immersed soon. It was in that speech that he uttered his contralto prediction that we as a people will get to the promised land. And at the points where our community prospects seemed most dim, we have fallen back on those words, believing that a man who saw his own fate so clearly was capable of seeing ours also. For many, that day on the Mall was a validation of Martin Luther King's promise. The headline for the New York Times on November 5, 2008 blares from the page, "Racial barrier falls in decisive victory. Obama's name appears in 96-point font. Only three events in the paper's history, the Apollo landing, Nixon's resignation, and September 11th, were heralded with equal dimensions. At Ebenezer Baptist, the church once pastored by Martin Luther King, the congregation gathered for a watch service. This was a deliberate recasting of history, an echo of those slaves who gathered on the last day of 1862, awaiting New Year's, the day that Emancipation Proclamation would take effect. In Nairobi, entire communities stayed up throughout the night, anticipating the moment when one of their descendants would be declared President of the United States. And in Grant Park in Chicago, 700,000 people jammed into a space alongside Lake Michigan to hear Barack Obama say these words, "Change has come to America." And it has, but the dimensions and contours of that change are not yet apparent. We will not know its full yield, the ways in which it will alter race and citizenship for many years to come. Our panel this evening is gathered to shed some light on the meaning of that change, the meaning of race in the age of Obama, more specifically, the meaning and implications of what we casually refer to now as the speech. Each of the panelists lends a unique perspective to its context, its themes, and its hidden meanings, and perhaps its place in history. I'll begin on my farthest right. Tracy Deneen Sharpley Whiting is professor of African American and Diaspora Studies and French and Italian at Vanderbilt University, where she is also the director of the African American and Diaspora Studies program, as well as the W.T. Bandy Center for Baudelaire and Modern French Studies, which is to say that Tracy does a lot of things. She's also the author, editor of 10 books. Her latest, the award-winning Pimps Up, Hoes Down, Hip Hop's Hold on Young Black Women, received the American Cultural Association Popular Culture Award, Popular Culture Association's 2007 Emily Toth Award for the best single work by one or more authors in women's issues in popular and American culture. That's Tracy. She's also the editor of this volume. To her left is Adam Mansbach. His most recent novel, The End of the Jews, was published in March 2008. His previous novel, Angry Black White Boy, or The Miscegenation of Macon Detournay, was the San Francisco Chronicle Best Book of 2005 and is taught at more than 50 universities. His previous books include the novel Shackling Water in 2002, the poetry collection Genius B-Boy Cynics Getting Weeded in the Garden of Delights, also in 2002, and the short story anthology A Fictional History of the United States with Huge Chunks Missing in 2006. To his left is Joan Morgan, who is an award, in addition to being an extremely tasteful person in choosing hats. We saw her come in, we just thought that she needed a theme song when she walked in. Joan is an award-winning journalist and author and provocative cultural critic. She began her professional writing career freelancing for The Village Voice before having her work published by Vibe, Madison, Interview, Ms. Magazine, More, Spin, and numerous others. Formerly the executive editor of Essence, Morgan coined the term hip-hop feminism in 1999 when she published her groundbreaking book, When Chickenheads Come Home to Roost. And if I can just tell you something really quickly, the students at Spelman are still required to read that. And I mentioned casually that Joan Morgan was a friend of mine, and my students accused me of name dropping. literally said, do you really know her? To Joan's left is Kelly Goff. Kelly is an expert on youth and minority voters. She emerged as one of the most recognizable political pundits for the 2008 presidential election cycle. She has appeared on numerous national programs, including the CBS Early Show, CNN's Anderson Cooper 360, MSNBC's Verdict with Dan Abrams, and BET's The Truth with Jeff Johnson, for which she served as a regular contributor. She's the author of the critically acclaimed book, Party Crashing, How the Hip-Hop Generation Declared Political Independence, which came out in 2008. One of the first books to explore the rise of Generation Obama. And to Kelly's left is Aubrey Hendricks. And I have two things, I have something in common with the last two people, which is that we all met in Denver at the Democratic Convention. And it was interesting because we were trying to figure out where we met because there were so many things going on at the Democratic Convention that it was like one big blur. Like, well, I was going to say hangover, but blur is better. Aubrey Hendricks. Jr. is professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary and visiting professor of religion and African American studies at Columbia University. He is also past president of Payne Theological Seminary, the oldest African American theological institution. Hendricks holds a PhD in religion from Princeton University. He is one of the most widely read academic biblical scholars in America. His most recent book is the award-winning The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted in 2006. So we have a very distinguished panel. I think we can welcome them. And if we look back just to the moment that the speech was, I think we can all pretty much is one of those where were you moments. We remember where we were when we saw the speech, or that we heard that he was the candidate, then candidate Obama, was going to give a speech on race in the context of the media firestorm that emerged surrounding comments made by Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And I guess we'll start with one question. In the days after the speech, we saw a great deal of acclaim in the media, and perhaps more adoration than analysis. If we can start with a general question, why did Barack Obama give this speech, and what did it accomplish?
Like an essay question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Was I being a professor? Let's start with why he gave this speech.
I can give a very short answer based on my former political hat, because I don't know if I'm the only former political operative up here, but in my previous life, I worked in politics on campaigns. This was a Hail Mary pass of a speech, if I've ever seen one. I mean, this speech was intended, if not to save the campaign, it was certainly... I don't know what you call what they use in ships to try to fill the hole when the water's coming in, but I would say that this speech was considered certainly part of that from a purely political perspective. And I think it's fascinating when apparently the background story is that his white senior advisors were the ones who actually did not want him to give the speech, but they were in agreement that something, with bunny quotation marks, needed to be done to address the Reverend Wright issue. So from a purely political standpoint, that is what the speech was, you know, about. So,
yeah, he had no choice. Barack Obama had, they had him on the ropes, and he had to try to distance himself from not only Jeremiah Wright, but from the kind of salient issues that are confronting Black America, mm-hmm. To show that he was not an angry Negro, and to show that he felt white people's pain, too. He had to distance himself. He had to try to put Jeremiah Wright in perspective, though he didn't distance himself, but he had to put Jeremiah Wright in perspective, because, yes, he was sinking fast, and he if he had blown it, he would have... He might well not have been president.
He wouldn't be president.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking with some people about the context in which this speech occurred, and we look at kind of political flameouts. Gary Hart, his presidential ambitions went up over routine infidelity. It's now routine. We'd consider it routine. infidelity.
Although not everybody does it on a boat called Monkey Business.
Monkey Business. Well,
extra. And poetic touch.
We're talking about right. Yeah. Muskie, his political ambitions were a casualty of just happening to get choked up, or perhaps getting choked up on the campaign trail. The question is whether he even was choked up or if it was cold. Howard Dean, if he had been one, perhaps in a key different, one note lower, perhaps he would still have been a viable candidate. He was off-key. One off-key scream, and his campaign was over. Was there something beyond that at play in terms of, in comparison, the 24-hour wall-to-wall repeating of Jeremiah Wright's snippets from Jeremiah Wright's speeches seemed far more inflammatory than any of those things. Was there something in this speech that enabled Barack Obama to sidestep what would reasonably have doomed another candidate?
Would you repeat that? Was there the last part?
Was there something in this speech that allowed him to sidestep a fate that would reasonably have doomed lots of other candidates?
Well, the speech itself, or actually I think the circumstances. I mean, because each one of those instances, these were in relationship to those individuals doing something that one may have found egregious or unacceptable. In Barack Obama's case, it simply, most people would say, it wasn't him, it was his pastor. And so I think we go back to what Obrey said, he had to effectively distance himself, or at least provide himself some cover with respect to what Jeremiah Wright was saying, as well as address the question of white bitterness, and to try and give context to that, so that he could appear to be speaking to the entire, I guess, the entire citizenry, that he could understand them and he could relate to them, and he was going to lay out the case in each one of these cases where we could dialogue about very difficult issues. And I think that that's where he gained points with a lot of people is simply because he appeared able to be able to dialogue with different people around this very volatile issue.
Mm. And being biracial, he came across, as I talked about in the essay I did for the book Living the Dream, he brought a measure of credibility that no one else at that level has ever had, frankly. I mean, because, you know, it's one thing when a white person says, I really understand, and that's why I'm really liberal, because I understand and I get it. And people say, no, okay, you might empathize, you might sympathize, but you can't really get it, right? And it's one thing for, an African-American to say, well, I understand why you might be frustrated because you feel that your son or daughter didn't miss getting into University of Michigan or wherever because you think it's unfair, but you still don't understand what it's going to be like for my kid when they try to compete. And for the first time that I can really think of, you had someone on that scale who is a black person with a white family, who, besides Halle Berry, because she's actually told similar stories, but she's never run for office as far as I know, who was able to say, I'm not saying I can speak for all of you and say that I understand everybody, but let's just talk about this. Here's where I'm coming from over here, and here's where I'm coming from over here. And it gave a measure of credibility. It's not that this conversation hasn't been had before. It's that usually there's always a certain audience that dismisses the person speaking outright by default of their skin color or their cultural background. And he was able to at least allow more than one audience to continue listening. There was a measure of credibility that his story imbued him with that others have not had.
I also think that we can't be revisionist in our recollection of this moment, because it wasn't like black folk had completely signed on to Barack Obama at this point either. There was still a lot of rumblings of he can't win, so I need to throw my support behind Hillary. He shouldn't run because he may be assassinated. And really the question is, how black is this black man who is not really African American with the white mother and the father from Kenya, maybe? Like, how black is he? So his handling of Jeremiah Wright was really important to the black community at large, because it was like, okay, you have a chance now to show that you have truly earned your black card, because for some of us, the jury is still very much out.
You know, I'm glad you raised that point. In your essay, you write, in very real ways, Wright was being scapegoated for sentiments many African Americans shared, just usually not when white folks were watching. Any subsequent decision he made to stand, to quote, stand wrong and strong by justifying his stance in the media might have been seen as everything from politically imprudent to embarrassingly crab in a barrel-ish. Still, there was little question that as far as the black vote was concerned, Wright would sooner be forgiven for potentially torpedoing the chances of the first black man to have a serious shot at the presidency than Obama would be for appearing to save his political ass by throwing a black man under the bus. So, in this sense,
you know. Yeah, I said that.
I was reading this, and I was like, I'm going to have to say the A word in the Schomburg, which is kind of like saying it in church almost.
Try saying it in front of my mother.
Oh, okay. She didn't actually write that. That was me embellishing.
That was the editor embellishing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question I have is, was Wright thrown under the bus? One. And two, you talk about in this essay very, at length and very pointedly, the way in which Barack Obama forced people to think about African-American identity in ways that weren't new but often go unnoticed. So I wondered if you could talk about those themes in your essay.
Okay. Yeah, the first question, what did I think that Barack Obama threw Jeremiah Wright under the bus? And the absolute answer for that to me is no. I think that he managed to be critical, But I think he managed to be very compassionate. I think he managed to give Jeremiah Wright a humanity and a context which no one else in the media was doing. And I think that he stood besides that relationship. I mean, I think Jeremiah Wright probably threw him under the bus, quite frankly, rather than the other way around. My approach in my essay was a little different because I was writing from the perspective of being someone who is black and an American citizen, but not someone who is not American born. So I am not African American. I am certainly what I call a hyphenated American and black in the sense that I'm Jamaican born and what I consider black and bicultural. Which means that I'm very much American, but I'm culturally extremely Jamaican and very proud of that. So it was very easy for me to identify this, like, well, how black is this person really thing, because that's something that immigrant blacks, first and second generation, experience all the time. Because the terms African American and black in America are used interchangeably without acknowledgement of the other millions of immigrants that make up the black experience in America. I find that problematic. That's just me personally, but I find that problematic. I do think that some of the suspicion that was around Barack Obama's candidacy and his level of blackness initially was the kind of wariness that we tend to have about not knowing where to place that particular kind of black person in America that doesn't trace their experience specifically to the experience of American slavery. That doesn't mean that we don't trace our experience to some sort of slavery, obviously. The experiences of colonialism and imperialism in different parts of the world, you know, it's the same slave ship, it's just different stops, as far as I'm concerned. But we tend not to have that kind of broadness in our discussion of blackness. So to me, Barack Obama was a very very familiar figure, but what I appreciated most about the speech is that I think that it was a very nuanced conversation about race, a very nuanced conversation about the experience of blackness in America, and in an introduction of the possibility that blackness in America is a multi-ethnic, multicultural, and not at all a homogeneous experience. And I think that it's a really important point. So that was the speech was my opportunity to kind of talk about that a little bit.
It's interesting that you raised those points, because in reading that, I saw kind of an interesting connection with what Kelly was saying as Barack Obama's kind of representing this fusion of cultural exchanges that are within America itself. And in your essay is titled Living the Dream, you say, "The conflict between the ideals of America and a past abounding with racial upheaval has been a recurring theme throughout Barack Obama's political career. His first and only major political defeat came at the hands of Bobby Rush, the former Black Panther turned congressman. His political peer group of younger black elected officials, including current Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Congressman Archer Davis of Alabama, Obama's law school classmate, faced similar defeats during early runs against civil rights era black leaders in campaigns marked by accusations that the younger generation lacked the life experience to, quote, be black enough. And then you go on to say there was undeniably a sense that Obama would enjoy the fruits of the political promised land without having had to endure the long, hot, perilous walk through the desert that Jackson, Jesse Jackson, and others had to get there. It simply wasn't fair. And so if we kind of look at it in this context, beneath this concern about Obama being, quote, black enough, which you say I think a lot of us believed was overblown, and you mm-hmm. say this explicitly in your essay, is there something else beneath that? Is it more difficult for figures of his generation, people like Davis and Booker and Obama, to address moments of racial tragedy and injustice? We saw during the campaign, the Sean Bell verdict came down, and people criticized Barack Obama for giving a very tepid statement in response to it, or Oscar Grant, which happened shortly before the murder of Oscar Grant in the Oakland BART station, which happened shortly before the inauguration. Are they in some way less capable of addressing explicitly black issues than the previous generation that you mentioned?
Well, no, because to believe in the premise, first of all, of that question is to assume that quote-unquote black issues have not evolved in any capacity, right? Or to say that all that every single African-American would define their issues exactly the same way. And, you know, this came up when we did the 100 Days report card on the state of black America. I participated in a panel about that, and you had members of Congress on the panel, Congressman Conyers, and you had academics, and you had others. And one of the points that I raised there is that when it came up during the election, someone made a comment, and I'm trying to think of who it was specifically. When President Clinton made that demeaning remark after the South Carolina primary that was, well, Jackson won South Carolina too, right? Everyone was up in arms, rightfully so, myself included, because of course the presumption is that essentially all black candidates, I don't want to say look alike, but you know, certainly sound alike, think alike. There was an inference there, and it wasn't coming from me, it was coming from his statement. And people got upset because that's ridiculous to think that all of our leaders based on skin color would be expected to share the same political identity. It's a ridiculous assumption. So that's over there. The second thing I would say to that, though, is of course, someone who did not endure segregation, myself included, both of my parents did, is not going to be able to relate firsthand to that experience. That's a degradation that I have not known. And that being said, you can't punish someone for not having been born. You can't punish someone and hold them to a leadership standard based solely on that. That's just simply ridiculous. It was sort of like when people were holding one of the candidates the standard of he never served in the Vietnam War because he was 5 years old. No, and I'm being serious how this conversation came up, that if you didn't march, you weren't in Vietnam. But the last thing I want to say in response to that is, I know that you read an excerpt from that part of my essay, but one of the things that came right before the line about the promised land, just to sort of put in context, is right before that I spoke about Jesse Jackson making the comment about wanting to cut the president's nuts off, right?
Right.
And when someone says something like that, I think we can all agree that it's a little deeper than the person not being born in the right year, right?
I think
there's a bit of hostility so. That runs a little bit deeper than that.
I would say so.
Right? And so the last thing I want to say in terms of putting all my cards on the table in that in context, one of the things I talk about in this essay is something I never discussed publicly before, which is specifically a family member of mine, and I've not said who it was out of respect for their privacy. But it was a really, I thought, profound things in terms of putting things in perspective for the younger generation or the post-civil rights generation, as we're called, which is a story that my mother told me during the Reverend Wright incident. I was doing a lot of television at that time. And, you know, obviously I was getting asked about it quite a bit. And my mother, I was getting into lots of arguments with people on different networks. And my mother actually said to me just in a conversation, she said, you know, so-and-so in our family, she said, you know, told me something interesting today. I said, oh, well, what did he tell you? And she said, well, he told me that when he was six, a man threatened to lynch him. And I said, I'm sorry, you know, what? And she said, well, yeah, he just brought it up out of the blue. Right? Out of the blue. It came up during the criticism of Reverend Wright. It just came up in conversation. It came up, and I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, he was playing with a little girl, he said. And someone said, if we ever catch you talking to that girl again, you're going to find yourself swinging from that tree right there. And she asked him, well, did you tell your parents? Of course not. I didn't want my father to get hurt. Right? And this is someone in our family who's never shared this story with anyone. Right? And so there's a measure of emotional collateral damage that we have not discussed in this country. Or as my literary agent said, there is a level of post-traumatic stress disorder. We talk about it for Vietnam vets, but it's never been discussed with this generation, particularly that generation of men in this country. And I think that what the Reverend Wright situation did in my family, and I don't think I'm alone here, is it forced us to talk about some of that stuff, including the president. I mean, even by touching upon it, I think that Joan was completely right. There was a measure of humanity I felt that he allowed the Reverend, and not just the Reverend, but other men like him, by saying, I'm not defending what he said, but I want to provide a context for this anger.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's, in terms of the context of the anger, if we can kind of look at your to your left, you spend, Obrey Hendricks, you spend a great bit of your essay actually talking about Jeremiah Wright and his context. And you know, the essay, the title of your essay is A More Perfect High-Tech Lynching, which I think says, you know, something in itself. You say, you also quote Common, the rapper Common, in response to allegations that people had that Jeremiah Wright was held racial animus toward whites. Common, you quote Common, who grew up in Trinity Church, and he says he really wasn't against white people or another race. He was against a system that was oppressing people. And regarding the speech itself, you say, throughout the speech, Obama chided Wright for recounting that history, talking about the history of Jim Crow and segregation, and the kind of daily degradations that went with it. The remarks, and quoting Barack Obama, you say, the remarks by Jeremiah Wright that have caused this recent firestorm expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country, a view that sees white racism as endemic. And then at the end of Obama's quote, yet this was a point he himself clearly made with his own repeated historical references in this speech, though with much more subtlety and political finesse. That was the major difference between the treatment of race in Obama's A More Perfect Union and in Wright's pronouncements. Obama soft-pedaled the full implications of his observations on race, while Wright plumbed the full range of meanings and effects of racism in America. Is this a polite way of saying that in crafting the speech, Obama had sold something short, I won't say out, but had sold something short in terms of the history of race and its impact, not only historically for someone of Wright's generation, but perhaps for the young people who are growing up on the south side of Chicago and in Harlem, in southwest Atlanta, and so on? And to be more succinct, did Barack Obama unjustly consign racism to a relic of history in the past?
No, he didn't. He didn't consign his relic of the past, because he talked about, in the speech, he talked a lot about, he spoke in the present tense often. He talked about the continuing legacy of opposition to Brown versus Board of Education and that. But he did go out of his way to acknowledge, to not give the full weight, not to give full weight, I'm trying to be careful here, not to give full weight to the existential horror of black folks under white supremacy. And I don't think it was a betrayal. I think it was an unfortunate position he was put in. He made a strategic choice. And there's a question he had to ask himself. Do I really acknowledge what's going on in this society and acknowledge the truth in various statements of Jeremiah Wright, and thereby speak out of my heart and my truth, and also not and also protect Jeremiah Wright in the doing, or do I put myself in the position to do more good, do as much good as I can for as many people as I can, rather than being concerned about one person? And so he did soft-pedal it. He made many of the same observations as Jeremiah Wright in terms of the endemic nature of white supremacy, but he said it with finesse. And part of the problem he had with Jeremiah Wright, he actually said, he talked about his incendiary statements. And see, what we have to keep in context, Barack Obama was a parishioner of Jeremiah Wright's for 20 years. Anybody who's ever heard Jeremiah Wright speak, if you're under Jeremiah Wright for a week, you know exactly where he stands, and
And if you reject it, you're not going to stay for 20 years. Also, the man, because he's brilliant, he in 20 years, he saw the man's point. Okay, so he knew that what Jeremiah was saying. He knew where he was coming from. He knew there was truth underlying it. But in saying that he was incendiary and that he rejected his endemic, his characterization of racism as endemic in American life, yeah, he soft-pedaled it. He made a choice, strategic choice. Now, I also say it is to America's shame that anyone had to be put in that position. No one should have to be put in the position where they have to repudiate a religious leader, being a rabbi or an imam or anyone else. And also, as we know, it's only black folk who really get put in that position. All those fundamentalist right-wing white nut preachers, they got off you know, scot-free. So yeah, the man took it. He soft-pedaled it, but he didn't have a choice. He wouldn't be president if he hadn't. But to his credit, he said it in coded ways. And he did talk about the history of racism. And even though he let people off the hook, as Adam said, white people off the hook, he did acknowledge in his own way, his own subtle way, what we're faced with in America's black people.
I wanted to ask a question of Tracy. You edited this book. You actually sent out the call. You pulled this project together. And I wanted to ask you a question that's a little bit open-ended. You, if I can read from your introduction, you write regarding the speech, Obama empathizes with the scattered dreams of his African father, the shattered dreams of his white grandfather, the righteous bitterness of Reverend Wright, and the stoicism of his white grandmother. At peace with his white and African inheritance, at home in his blackness, and thoroughly reconciled in his claim to Americanness, a more perfect union, he casts out, excuse me, with a more perfect union, he casts out his biography with where seemingly disparate impossibilities are sublimely made whole into a bridge, an invitation, a suggestion to cross. And so in addition to that thinking that's a very elegant paragraph.
Thank you.
I had a question that is a little bit open-ended, which is, having seen the speech in 2008 when he gave it, and having had the experience of editing this book and thinking about the speech a lot more than most of us have since he gave it, is there anything that you discern from it, from candidate Obama giving this speech, and the way that President Obama has handled race or handled identity or handled these issues beyond then? So thinking about this speech and all this time, kind of what do you take away from it?
Oh, yeah, that's a big question. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is I did not watch the speech when he initially gave it. My tendency with candidate Obama was that oftentimes he would make certain what they call gaffes at certain moments, especially if he were kind of speaking, and then it would be amplified. And because of all of the hoo-ha surrounding the Reverend Wright episode, I just didn't know what to expect. And so I simply tuned out. I came back to it later to watch it, and not when it was streaming live. And so it was after that I got the reception of the speech. And so and the idea for the book on the speech, of course, was not my idea, I have to say. It was the editor of Bloomsbury who actually came to me with the idea for the speech. He thought it was a speech that needed to be memorialized. It had saved a campaign, and he kept just saying, calling it the speech, the speech. And so I said, okay, well, we'll call it the speech. Since that's what he kept calling it. He didn't say a more perfect union, you know, or whatever. And so I had to actually go back. Viewing it was one thing, but actually reading it was something else. And what I do see is there is a consistency. I think, in truth, there are aspects of President Obama that where we can see a certain moments of radicalism or, you know, left progressive tendencies. I mean, he became, you know, kind of named the progressive candidate. However, I think he really is a moderate. And I think the speech demonstrates the kind of individual he is, that he is one of moderation. And so when I was reading through the speech, and I was also, actually, that particular passage was referring to the Dreams memoir that a lot of people neglected to read to get a better sense of what makes Obama tick. And so it was actually from those passages in combined with the speech that I think I got a better sense of, you know, why so many writers in the volume could, you know, well, of course, when I contacted everybody, I was like, I want you to write on this, you know, and Joan kind of bucked me. No, I want to write on this. But, you know, and I was like, okay, well, that's a good idea too, Joan. Let's go with that, because that brings something very different to the conversation. But so it makes it rich because we don't have a great deal of overlap with Returns to Themes. But what I noticed was, you know, in the dreams, we saw him discussing having this this white grandmother who, of course, could not stay home in an era in which staying at home was what, you know, middle class white women did. Instead, she had to work. And so she had to accept that she wasn't going to be able to kind of do the things that her play bridge all day or do whatnot. And the grandfather, who was a failed salesman and who really depended upon the grandmother's income as she rose up through the ranks. And he talks about in very poignant ways the disappointment. And so for me, in a very real sense, I think that Obama gets white bitterness. In a way in which I think we, at that moment when we were listening to him, we ceded that authority to him because he was right in the midst of it, listening to his grandfather calling on the phone, trying to line up customers, and was just bitter about it. And his grandmother had to accept certain things. And then, of course, trying to get to know his father, who he had a very kind of, you know, really no relationship with, except that it was mediated through the ideals that his mother attempted to pass on. And then the relationship with the mother as well. And so I think, again, the speech for me marks him as a moderate in a great deal of ways, and what it also did for me was demonstrate how he could bring all of these things together, and for so many of us to believe we can see certain things in Obama that we see in ourselves. He has a very invitational character. He's a very invitational politician, and so I still think that, but I think he's right now being caught in some interesting crosshairs around policy. And I think that's what, after all the warm and fuzzy is gone about Obama, we really are going to have to take a hard, cold look at policy, you know, and what he's able to move forward. You know, many people would like him to come back at this issue of race. That's not something that he wants to do, but, you know, he's going to have to at some point. He's just not going to be able to get away from it, and I think he understands that. I think he's a realist. He's very pragmatic. And if nothing else, you do get that from the speech as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Adam into this conversation because I think you have an interesting perspective on this speech. Your piece is called The Audacity of Post-Racism. And you share a concern. Would you say, for my part, I watched the speech in my living room on a laptop computer with tinny speakers, and I was with Obama until he let white people off the hook. Though I grasped the political necessity of the move, my expectations of this man were sufficiently high that it was disheartening to hear him fudge the difference between institutional racism and white bitterness. 3 weeks earlier, I'd felt a similar sense of letdown when, challenged at a debate in Ohio to further denounce Minister Louis Farrakhan, Obama responded by articulating the need to mend black-Jewish relations, then proceeded to reinscribe the very paradigm that has served to rend them. I say this as a white person, a Jew, and an enthusiastic Obama supporter. So to what extent did this exemption or exoneration, do you think, that he offered whites factor into the way that the speech was received, and perhaps beyond that, his broader success as a politician?
I think it was absolutely crucial. I think, as you said earlier, the initial reception of the speech was not critical, either in the sense of critical or critical-minded. It was one of relief and self-congratulation that we were at a point where a black candidate could give a 30-minute speech on race on primetime television, which could ultimately make white people feel good about themselves. And when I say that he let white people off the hook and that he fudged the difference between institutional racism and white bitterness, you know, I refer to the way that he characterized anger at affirmative action and even at the thought that others might view them as prejudiced, as similar to the on the part of white people, as similar to the frustration felt by victims of entrenched structural racism. To me, that's, again, politically necessary, but disingenuous and borderline irresponsible. And in order to do it, it's interesting to look at the language that this wordsmith has to apply in order to sell that. And in order to make that work, what Obama is forced to do is abandon the language of the empirical, the language of facts, of statistics, the language that tells us that a white felon has a better chance of getting a job interview than a black applicant with no criminal record, as demonstrated by a recent study at Princeton University. The language of the empirical does not serve this argument. The language of the emotional is the only language that will allow this point, this kind of eliding of factual realities to fly. So hence, we get the focus on how people feel, whether they feel privileged or not, whether they feel racist or not, rather than the objective realities of what they have and what they do and what they say. And, you know, this kind of soft focus abstraction of racial realities is not limited to the speech. We see it throughout the campaign. The whole notion of post-racism in itself is that. It's this abstracting of reality. And, you know, naturally one must be black to be a candidate for post-racial status, right? There's not a lot of discussion about whether Hillary Clinton is white enough or too white or Mitt Romney, you know? Although he would white. Probably be, he's by any standard, he's the whitest man in America.
I heard some white people saying that Mitt Romney going like, wow, he's really white.
Yeah, certainly. You got ghosts saying he's too white. But you know, what this does, the notion of post-racism obscures the realities of structural entrenched racism. The fact that a black person is never so lacking in blackness culturally or personally or politically or in any other context by any other standard to find himself or herself exempt from discrimination. That's what post-racism ultimately guides us toward. And, you know, I think that in terms of, as Obi pointed out, it is a specific function of black leaders and public figures being asked to denounce the views of religious contemporaries and cohorts. It's not something that you see having to happen on the right. When there are calls for it, the right simply refuses to do it.
That didn't happen with Hagee, though.
It happened on a minor level, but who was asked to do it? Yeah. Obama was asked to do it when he called on him for the inauguration.
No. Warren. Right.
What's that? Oh, Warren. I'm sorry, Warren. Yeah. Hagee. Okay, yeah, Hagee. But McCain didn't go very far.
It was a tit for tat after Wright.
McCain didn't go very far. McCain, yeah, his association was different.
They didn't push him very hard.
But also because he didn't go to the church. It was a tit for tat with Wright. Hagee probably never would have happened had it not been Wright. You know, but I think it's an important context.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. I think it's a lot less of a register on the Richter scale of this campaign, as far as I'm concerned. Hagee, absolutely. McCain and Hagee's names will not be perpetually linked.
He didn't go to his church.
You know, the way that but what do we know about where McCain did go to church?
Can you tell us where his church was? He and Bush both didn't go to church.
Or who his
Bush went to church or Palin actually.
Hagee got off scot-free and everybody who was around him. They're around all those right-wing nuts and McCain had been in Farwell's university and said all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And they, you know,
after
announcing
him first.
And they're never brought on the carpet like we are. No.
Right. In terms of Obama and Farrakhan, you know, preceding Wright, he was asked by Hillary Clinton at the debate repeatedly to denounce Farrakhan, even after he seemingly had done so. She was like, no, take it further. You know,
reject, denounce.
Yeah. Here's a knife. You know, it was like, what do I have to do here? And, you know, what? And I think, you know, this fits into what I see in terms of Obama's comments on the rending of a black Jewish relationship or a civil rights alliance or a tradition of progressive action in those two communities. When I say that he reinscribed them, I mean that what he did by denouncing Farrakhan, by throwing that red meat to a certain section of Jewish voting bloc, is rather than say, you know what, the comments to which Jews object on the part of Farrakhan, like the comments to which they object on the part of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, are 20-plus years old by now. All three of these men, A, have renounced those comments, have moved on. The context in which some of them occurred to begin with are highly questionable and have been abstracted into sound bites, much like what Reverend Wright said. And also, the emergence of Obama and grassroots hip-hop generation leadership has effectively moved those folks out of centrality anyway. And the Jewish community has never let go of those comments, returns to them all the time, and Obama sort of endorsed that, you know, reliance on those pickled comments, which ultimately, to me, are about a kind of Jewish pullback from an investment in black equality and in the continuation of doing that work. There's a changing of bedfellows, and the premise that those leaders and those comments are representative and somehow evoke a significant specter of black anti-Semitism, you know, is fairly ridiculous and needs to be broken apart and moved beyond. And Obama could have done that. He would have had a significant price to pay. It may have been politically inopportune, much as not letting white people off the hook would have been in this more, important moment of speech making. But it was, you know, again, a pragmatic approach which was not about actually changing paradigms or moving beyond the old language of race, and instead doing what was necessary and expedient to get where he needs to go. And ultimately, it was the right thing to do, and I agree with Tracy that he is going to have to return to race at some point. I hope that he does it during his second term. I think that's the right move. But, you know, at some point, we are going to have to demand a moment of radical, unflinching bravery from Obama. He's going to have to be brave enough to frame the road to racial reconciliation in the same terms he's been brave enough to apply to climate control, right? He's got to say, this is a journey that will require real sacrifice, profound reevaluation of our lifestyles and the unsustainable practices on which they're built. You know, he's got to declare to white America, look into the living rooms and say institutional racism is alive and well. It benefits all those considered white and also extracts from them a high moral toll. And we have to deal with this.
And stop plotting to shoot me. You have to say
that. Yeah, yeah. And also, could you please put the guns away and stay, don't come to the healthcare forums.
Jelani, can I say
sure.
something?
Oh, sure.
It's what happens when you make me wait till I'm, you know, last. I gotta,
clearly.
I'm not here to look pretty.
You know, one of the I should preface this with Adam is a dear friend, and his ability to call white people out is one of the reasons that he is a dear friend. But I will also say that even if we have this moment where Obama has to, as you say, tackle this issue of race again, we should be prepared for the fact that some of us are not going to like what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the interesting ways that Obama functions to me is very much like the Yoruba figure of Elegba, where we see the red when we need to see the red, and we see him as black when we need to see him as black. And when we stand at the crossroads, he becomes something else entirely different. And it is that ability that allows him to move and navigate politically, emotionally, for some people spiritually throughout the world in the way that which he does. I see that as a tremendous strength. Also, his experience of blackness, just like Adam's experience of whiteness may be very contrary to another white person's experience of whiteness. I think that we have to constantly allow this president to express the experience of blackness as he truly experiences it. So, you know, I think that there is an ability to speak in a way that is very linear and frank about American race relationships when you don't have to go home to sit down to have Thanksgiving dinner with your white grandmother. That is just a human and emotional reality. And I think that his family is not at all atypical of American families as we see this new America that we are evolving into.
Barack Obama's family.
Yes, one of the biggest, brouhahas that my son got, my 10-year-old, he wasn't 10 at the time, he might have been 6, got on the school bus, was like practically coming to blows with this kid who told him that it was ridiculous that he had a middle name that was Mandarin Chinese because he couldn't believe that my son had a Chinese grandmother. He certainly could not understand that his Chinese grandmother lived in Jamaica. That was just a foreign concept. And that is because we are allowed to have these scripts, these narrative scripts around race in America that say, this is where it stands, this is where you believe. And it's not that any of those scripts are wrong, it's just that it's one script. And there are many, many scripts being played out on the American racial landscape simultaneously. Mm. And until we understand that as Americans, we are going to be stuck in this place, looping the same conversations over and over and over again. So yes, I'm looking forward to that moment again, but I guarantee you we're not all going to like what he has to say.
Oh, yeah. No. Mitt Romney definitely won't.
Question that will come maybe tie these things in. Is it possible to say that these 8 months that he has been in office have not been, 9 months that he's been in office have not been absent, him having to address, albeit race, albeit in oblique ways? We could point to perhaps his speech to the NAACP. We could point to his handling of the Skip Gates issue. And we could point to equally his rejection of Jimmy Carter's comments when he said that much of the conflict that stemmed around health care and the birthers and so on was out of racial animosity. And Robert Gibbs, speaking on behalf of the president, said that Barack Obama does not feel that to be the case. There's one question I think that does come to mind, though, which is he betraying a tendency to hold blacks accountable for race in ways that he doesn't hold whites accountable? Well, at least what I've heard, I'm not saying necessarily this is my opinion, but what I've heard in response to the Father's Day speech, in response to the speech to the NAACP, where he chided young African-Americans to do better, even in the theme within the speech, A More Perfect Union, where he criticized some black leadership for investing in racism as a business strategy, essentially a political strategy. And then even among some delegates around the convention, there were people saying, well, when is he going to hold white people accountable as well? Is there any merit to those charges?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, particularly around the fatherhood question, I mean, I realize some of that came as a result of his personal experience, his personal issues around fatherhood and abandonment. But when you talk about, the issue of black men not doing this, that, and the other, and you don't put it in context of the structural issues and problems that sometimes beat down people psycho-emotionally, that make them unable to support families, and all the kinds of psycho-emotional problems that we know bedevil the black community. When you don't put it in context, then what you're essentially saying to the rest of America is, you guys are just, it's all on you. You got to start being more responsible. He doesn't talk about, let's remove some of the structural impediments to to raising a family. And in so doing, he plays into the stereotypes of the irresponsible black men who are irresponsible because of their own lights. He doesn't talk about any other community. He doesn't talk about their problems, for instance, in family type problems in the Hispanic community that that are very high. Pardon me. He doesn't talk to them to anywhere near the extent he talked about black men. So it was problematic to me because he didn't put it in context, and in so doing, he let America off the hook. And so white folks saying, "Yeah, these black men are just so irresponsible." Mm-hmm. But it doesn't talk about unemployment, doesn't talk about any of the kind of things
that helped to inform that. And you know, and I'm not taking us off the hook, but let's tell the whole story.
Mm-hmm. I think there's
Kelly was holding up a comment for a minute. What were you going to say?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize. Okay. I'm going to respectfully disagree, at least with that particular example, because I think that if you're there before the NAACP and you're asked to give a speech, and then that's a great vehicle, forum, and platform to talk about one of the biggest issues plaguing our community. And I think that while, yes, statistically there are more white children born out of wedlock than there are black children, two-thirds of black children are currently born out of wedlock. And those children are not being born into families helmed by Rod Stewart or Mick Jagger or Madonna or any of these other, you know, rich white people who were able to write checks and sort of write the problem away. There are very intrinsic cultural problems that are plaguing our community. And if he's not going to talk about it, then who is?
I'm not saying he shouldn't talk about it. I'm saying he should tell the whole story.
And I think that perhaps if you're talking about something like incarceration, sure, let's talk about context or Rockefeller drug laws. But I'm not exactly sure what you expect him to say when he has an audience full of African Americans and he has the opportunity to say, let's talk about not having children we can't afford to take care of.
Well, this is something he's run into problems with before. Right? The notion of whether a situation for the president of the United States or even a candidate for the presidency can ever be kind of a closed door meeting is something he struggled with in the past. You remember the famous speech that came close to derailing him as well, where in San Francisco he talked about how people held on to guns and religion, you know, and this he was branded as an elitist. He was said not to understand. This was when Ohio was a battleground state, and you know, Hillary slammed him for this speech. Everybody was up in arms about this. Pennsylvania as well. And I think, you know, intrinsically in the idea of a black president speaking to the NAACP or to any kind of black community group, you know, there's the presumption that this is perhaps some kind of in-group situation, right? It's not going to be the same as him speaking to white America or to an organization that has a history of representing white America in some kind of public context. And I think that notion is tricky, the idea of what is fully public and what is sort of semi-public has been something that's tripped him up before. But I think ultimately that is why perhaps we're not hearing him talk about institutional racism, about the reasons for these things, for you know the plague of incarceration, the inherent injustice in the judicial system and the system of sentencing in this country. There may be a sense in which he thinks that those things are a given in a certain context that people understand them, but those cameras are not reporting on behalf of the people he's talking to. He's actually talking to the entire country, and it ends up giving fodder if he doesn't, as you say, Aubrey, tie this into structural institutional racism in a way that is very explicit that everybody can understand. Otherwise, he looks like he is just giving an angry, paternalistic kind of speech.
Well, I think that's ultimately what we're dealing with. We've seen a lot of the cultural analysis, and we need to see some more structural analysis, because the issue that we're talking about is both cultural and structural. And so this, again, comes down to the policy, right? Because even when, as you mentioned, the Gates thing, you know, and he's like, it's ridiculous, but at the simultaneously, you're the president, you know, you can help set policy around certain issues of, you know, policing and, you know, and law enforcement. I mean, so there are a number of ways in which interventions can be made. And again, we will have to see.
If he wants to do that, what that would be.
But let me say, a couple minutes for questions, so just a couple of people can come up to this microphone, and we'll get to your questions in a minute. We have a very few minutes for questions.
I want to make it clear. I was a parent of a daughter. I'm not about exculpating black men from any irresponsibility that we might show as a body, but at the same time, Adam is correct. When you're speaking to the world and you're talking about black men being irresponsible, this, that, and the other, that's not a policy statement. And you're not talking in the basement of a church. And when you have all these stereotypes about how bad we are, and so you're taking white folks off the hook, there are no structural problems. These men are just irresponsible. Now, I think that's tone deafness on his part, because he did not grow up in the black communities that's sensitive to these kinds of things. He can't be held responsible for that, but it's still a reality. He's going to have to
Can I add one bit of context to this? It was the Father's Day speech that immediately generated the Jesse Jackson comment, castration comments. Now, as a historian, one of the things that you do is you research things and you look at where people stand. Jesse Jackson had made a very similar speech during his 1988 presidential campaign that won him praise from a number of white journalists and some black ones, including Stanley Crouch, who was writing about him at the time. And so it was very much a case of Jackson taking issue with something that he had done himself. But I think this raises a different question, which we might want to grapple with, which is two things. The first half of the Father's Day speech that Barack Obama gave talked about structural issues. No one remembers that part of the speech, but if you go back and read the first half of that speech, the entire top half of it talks about structural issues. The only part that people refer to is the part where he said that men had to be held accountable for not raising their children and so on and so on and so forth. But in that context, if Jesse Jackson makes this comment, if Barack Obama makes this comment, aren't they kind of taking a liberty and saying, well, I am part of this community and I can speak? Because in the conversations I have with my friends, who some of whom are unfortunately in positions where they have children with people who are not being responsible, racism doesn't really come up that much. You know, a lot of like words that start with M and start with F and then start with other kinds of terminology. I mean, those terms come up, but we don't really talk about racism very much. So isn't this, or is it the case that this person is just speaking as a member of this community?
Not if the Fox News cameras are rolling. That's probably not the case when you and your friends are talking.
Well, okay.
Let me elaborate by just saying that this is a man and a campaign that was strategically masterful, ran one of the tightest, best campaigns, the most drama-free campaigns in the history of this country. And that kind of strategic thinking and care with message, I think, has to extend past the campaign and into the presidency. That kind of discipline and an awareness of how words can be manipulated is crucial. And certainly some of those words in that speech might have been snipped and abstracted. But I think, you know, given the potential for disaster, Obama has to construct his words in such a way that that kind of manipulation is as difficult as it can possibly be.
Disaster for who?
We will try to get to all of your questions. We have a few minutes for them. If we can start, why don't we do this? Why don't we do the questions two at a time? And then the panelists can respond. So the first two people will raise their question, and then the next two people, and then the gentleman at the end.
I don't have a question,
microphone.
But I...
Microphone.
The microphone? Is it working? Okay.
It's working.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. You're sitting there...
Okay, oh wait, can I say one thing?
No question?
That in order for this to work, everyone's questions should be phrased within 20 seconds or so.
Okay.
Let's say 20 to 30 seconds,
starting now. You're sitting there criticizing the most important leader in American history since Abraham Lincoln. In order for Barack Obama to settle the problems in this country, he would need to be president for 40 or 50 years. So we should only be thankful that he has gotten the most important legislation, almost gotten the most important legislation in American history, passed the health care bill since Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing 22 million people. This man is trying to be president of 300 million people, black, white, and all. So never criticize, a man with such great intentions.
Okay.
Really, never?
Just
I don't agree with that.
Just as a point of note, I'm a historian, so I quibble about this. There are about 4.5 million African Americans who were enslaved at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. There were about 22 million whites in the North. So the Emancipation Proclamation did, in effect, emancipate them from some things as well.
No,
this is kind of a one-go-round. Can we have the next person?
Is there a reaction by the panel to my statement?
There's two people at a time.
What does that mean?
That means... Yes.
Hi, I just want to thank the panelists. This is a great conversation, and I'm really happy to hear that we're talking about institutional racism and structural racism. I think the speech was incredible, and I think the only way you can get to those issues is if you deal with the emotions that surround racism first. And so I guess my question is, we keep saying we need to get back to race, but to me, that conversation is kind of over. At what point do we as a black community start to look at race within the context of structure? I just think we need to really stop talking about race separate from capitalism, separate from class, separate from economics. So I'm just wondering, the question is really, are we doing ourselves a disservice by just saying race or structure without really explaining what that means?
Okay, so we have two things for us to respond to. One is to, we should not criticize Barack Obama because of his intentions and what he has on his plate so far. And the other is, are we doing this conversation a disservice by discussing race outside of the broader context?
I'm going to jump in with that. I think that, you know, I mean, I think anybody who hears me speaking knows that I'm a Barack Obama fan. At the same time, there's a difference between criticizing someone and accountability. And right. As an American citizen, right. I hold every single president that I elected accountable. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you negate to do that, that you undermine the very principle of democracy that this country is supposed to be about. I take that very seriously. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that I think that race has always needed these complicated, we should constantly strive to complicate these conversations around race, but it didn't become necessary when Barack Obama became president. And I don't think that it's his responsibility as the president of the United States to make this issue. Where are the other voices who have been doing this kind of work in the trenches, who have incredible theories, platforms? We should be creating the vehicles where these voices can be heard. We should be asking that their presence be on CNN and MSNBC and friggin' Fox, as opposed to the talking heads that we see who are doing absolutely nothing. Mm. This job is not only up to President Obama, it's up to every single one of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like to say, I am, about this criticizing Obama, you know, I was on an advisory committee to the campaign, very minor advisory committee to the campaign, but I was very, very much involved like many other people. I'm 100% supporter, have been 100% supporter of him. I think it was a great speech. I was moved to tears by the speech. At the same time, as a citizen and as an intellectual, but more importantly, as a citizen, I have a responsibility to raise issues and hold them accountable. But not only that, we don't know the ways to shore him up and to support him or to try to raise consciousness and advise him unless we discuss these contradictions and these problems. So this is a very healthy process. I'd be very frightened if we had someone elected and just because they're black, everybody fell in lockstep behind them. Mm. That would be irresponsible. And not only that, we have no part, no guarantee that things would go the way that they should go for us. Now, what we should do, I think the sister's right. We have to be part of the policy debate. And also, Joan, you hit it on the head. We have all these talking heads, but you know, Emile Brock said something to me one night at the Iridium. He said, you know, I was on a panel with a lot of so-called socialist intellectuals. And he said, I asked first, you know, where are the socialists? Second, where are the organizations? Mm-hmm. And all these talking heads, they make good points, but they don't have any organizations behind them, nor are they really making
policy proposals. And so we need to try to, as some kind of way to try to lift some of these people up, or at least try to get our intellectuals, the talking heads, involved with some organization so that they're pushing some kind of program and not just saying a lot of clever things, which might be right on, but they have no meaning and no continuity. It's up to us to have to make sure that Barack Obama does what he is supposed to do as the president of all of the people. And if we sit silently by, or if we just sit back and snipe at him or wave and say you're doing a great job, then we can't complain, and we have no guarantee that things are going to go the way that we feel they should go.
And just to add real quickly that I think it's indicative of the media environment that we have created in this country, that we have begun to think of criticism not as something that can be constructive and open and dialectical, but that is almost by definition mean-spirited and proceeding in sound bites and a pitched battle between diametrically opposed forces.
Absolutely.
We have to reconceive of the whole nature of what criticism can be and how it can be something that lifts us up.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I'll be honest with you, Square Business. I was in the movement, so I'm a little older than y'all. And what civil rights activists and leaders used to do is visit black colleges and say, this is how we did it, this is how it looks like you should do it. And it seems like y'all haven't been talking to enough of the old boys. Now, first of all, we criticize Obama because we love him. Think about it. And we're afraid that he might blow it and people might hurt him. So there needs to be a reading list. Dick Gregory used to give a reading list so you can intelligently talk about somebody before you start influencing somebody. So I will ask you, how many of you have gone through the Dr. King site? How many of you have seen the movie Believe? Being in Hawaii had a lot to do with it. And it took me some time to catch on to when he's talking to black people. And I said, oh my God, he's talking to us. And I didn't even pick it up. So there's a lot of things. Listen to with Andy Young. Have you heard Ogletree talk about...
Can you phrase your question, please?
Yes, I already said. I said, have you seen Believe? Have you talked to... Have you read The King's Sight?
Yes.
More specifically, can you wrap up your question?
Yes, well,
Some of us have written about these things.
Thank you be to God. Thank you be to God. It's just some things that seem like y'all are missing the point.
Thank you.
He is a long-range strategist. When he took everybody down to that slave castle in Ghana, that's when he was ready to make his move for us.
Okay.
So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. And the next person.
In the essence of time, I'm going to try to make this very, very quick. In terms of race, I'm hearing it being on one side and not seeing the full scope of it. And as historians, every time there's black progress, white supremacy reacts. So when you had Reconstruction, you had the compromise to allow the president to come in and the soldiers to leave. When Jack Johnson is the heavyweight champion, you have Birth of a Nation to show the white supremacy again. Fast forward. Barack Obama is a master politician that ran the tightest, most effective presidential race in the history of this nation. And his whole impact, his family, and I mean his wife and those two babies and his mother-in-law, which you did not talk about, is such a beautiful example of
absolutely
something we have never seen in America. Mm-hmm. And the pushback to that, we don't see it because the way this brother walks, is he black enough? You look at him walk. He's got a Lenox Avenue bop before it was on Malcolm X. So I'm just saying, sometimes we repeating things that the oppressors say. Is he black enough? That came from the black supporters of Hillary Clinton. So, there were some things that were not put in context in terms of, saying you were wrong, but you did not put it in context. So this whole thing, you're giving strength to, is he black enough, as opposed to recognizing that we're all black in our own individual way.
Is there a comment?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No. No one said anything like that.
There are two points, if I understand them correctly. We've heard the questions. If anyone wants to respond.
I'll say really quickly, I wrote this essay which Tracy said was probably one of the most optimistic sounding ones in the book. But of course, a lot can change in 8 to 9 months. And of course, the irony is that when the book actually came out, from when I was putting the finishing touches on the essay, this whole optimistic perspective of the future of America and where we were headed towards race relations and Generation Y and how we're going to change the world in terms of race. And then, of course, the book comes out and you have people ripping up Rosa Parks posters at healthcare meetings and sending swastikas and the N-word to Congressman Scott. And I started wondering if perhaps I had, you know, people my age had jumped the gun a bit. But I ended up writing this piece for the Huffington Post, which ended up becoming one of the most widely read things I'd ever written and gotten a lot of extremely strong reaction, both for and against, including a bit of hate mail, that was titled Why I'm Grateful for Joe Wilson and the Fury of Racists. And specifically, Joe Wilson, for anyone who doesn't recall, was the congressman who shouted, "You lie," so disrespectfully to the president during the congressional address. And the reason the piece came from a conversation with my mom, who lived through the civil rights movement, and a conversation we were having about what Nancy Pelosi had said, about her concern that we were heading towards a new era of violence and how that was a very scary proposition for her. And my mom and I got into this conversation about specifically when this happens in our country and what drives people to that type of behavior. And we talked about exactly what that gentleman said, which is that people turn violent and really angry when they realize they're losing. Mm-hmm. Slaves are freed. Okay, we have to teach them a lesson and keep them in line, so let's start lynching them. They want to go to school with our kids. We can't let that happen. If we bomb a couple churches, maybe we'll scare them into submission. They want to start voting. Well, we'll teach them a lesson. And then, surprise, surprise, an African-American president gets elected president, and all of a sudden, scary rhetoric starts percolating up again. One of the reasons that I think a lot of this anger and hostility is coming, it's not just from his election, it's from the people who supported his election as well. And the people who supported his election were their kids and their grandkids. A lot of these people who are angry because the numbers show consistently, not just that young voters, a lot of them white, were some of the strongest supporters for his candidacy behind black voters when you look at the statistics. But also that when you look at the numbers, this generation of millennials, people born after 1977, support things like interracial relationships at numbers of 94%, when their parents 20 years ago supported them at numbers like 59%. Their grandparents supported it something like 50%. And I think there's an anger when you look at those numbers and you look at the direction in which our country is headed, in which it's becoming a minority-majority country, there's a lot of anger there because there's a lot of progress happening that's good. And so when I hold on to that, that can be helpful because I sort of look at it as, okay, Rush Limbaugh, you say whatever it is you feel you need to say, because we're becoming a different America, and in 10 years, it's going to be an America you're not going to want to live in, and that's okay with me.
And you can't have a football team.
And you're right.
You have the last question. I will say one quick thing, if I can just take 15 seconds of my own. I will say that one of the things that that I most try to convey to my students and I try to convey to people where I interact is that I think that as a community we should be beyond the point where we question other people's blackness, mm-hmm. where we question other people's cognizance of what it means to be black, and where we question other people's really credibility and willingness to speak. So for the generation that, or someone who was, quote, in the movement, we appreciate you, and we recognize you, and we award you, and we thank you for your struggles. For the people who came after that, we appreciate what they have to say and trust that they have studied and thought about their perspectives as not simply a perspective of people who happen to wander in off of Lenox Avenue.
By the way, I didn't come after. I was in the movement also from 14.
You deceptively
and
young.
I faced death numerous times. I was on the front line. So it's we have to be careful the kind of assumptions that one makes. I also think that we have a generation divide up on this panel.
Of course.
I think we have a generation divide because I see things differently than many of you. I see everything that you see, but at the same time, folk are angry because there is a black man in the White House.
They're angry.
It's more visceral. It's more visceral than that. It's not just it's not just that they're seeing things slipping away from them, which is a part of it. But they see a black man in the White House, they see his children, they hate his children.
That's a certainly
they call
a
them all kinds. But I'm saying it goes more deeply than that. I understand what you're saying, but it goes much more deeply as one. I lived through segregation, not a long period of time. That's why I had to come north. I have gone, in these 56 years, I've seen this hatred and this anger that has not changed.
You can't say it hasn't changed.
Is, wait a minute. I'm saying the stratum has not changed. I'm not saying that the country hasn't changed. I'm saying the nature of the hatred of black people that I've seen has not changed. This is what they're saying about Barack Obama now and the threats to kill him and the hatred of his very children. This is not new because they see that the demographics are changing. What it is showing is that we are in, to my mind, is that we're not as far ahead as we thought. This post-racial stuff, it's...
I don't believe it. I never said that I believe that there's a post-racial America, and I don't think anyone with a brain says that. But I think that you're... I guess I interpreted your message incorrectly, but I think to say that nothing has changed or...
I did say that.
Or is just is misrepresenting where our country is today.
I didn't say that. I said there was a stratum of anger. There is a type of
that
still continues, and a stratum of hatred that is the same. It's the same trajectory.
Among certain people, yes.
As a moderator, can I point out an area?
Can I say something?
Oh, Tracy.
I just wanted to say that I think. Well, I mean, I'm between, I guess, the two of you generationally. But I think it's interesting that we are seeing voice, life, and exposure to white anger at this particular moment in a way in which folks wanted to deny the kind of black anger that Jeremiah legitimately has.
Right.
And that a lot of people legitimately have. And I also feel like, you know, part of the reason why I jumped into the project with both feet and a symbol of what I think is a stellar cast of writers here is because, I mean, at the center of it is Jeremiah Wright. And this is why I definitely was so taken with Obery's piece as well as Adam's piece, because they were, the rest of ours were a little bit more hopeful and whatever, and they just kind of got down in the nitty gritty. Because I think that there is something profoundly dishonest about the ways in which people receive Jeremiah Wright's homilies. Because, I mean, it is part of the American Jeremiah tradition. Mm-hmm. And we were being intellectually dishonest to say that somehow he was out of sync, or he was wacko, or he was a wackadoodle,
crazy
and all of
man.
These things that they were saying. And that somehow his anger was not legitimate. People said the same thing about Malcolm. There were people who saw King as angry. And I think we're at a moment in this country where black people are supposed to not be angry. When in fact, there are a lot of black folks who have issues about what's going on in this country, and we have to give credence to those issues the same way that there are many of us panicked about the rise and tide of white violence. Mm-hmm. I think we have to talk about these things, but I think we are a country that's very much afraid of those kinds of discussions. And this is, for me, where the whole issue of race linked to structural issues are very important, because the people are angry because you don't want to sit next to them. You know, that's not the issue. That's not why they're upset. They're upset about structural inequalities, right? Access and opportunities. And this is what Jeremiah Wright was upset about.
Right.
This is what he was talking about. He was talking about genocides. He was talking about, you know, all sorts of other things that are very important to put on the table. And I think, you know, Obama strategically had to do what he had to do. But, I mean, I do think we do need to come back to those very legitimate issues.
Yes, yes.
And that's why that language of white victimhood that's being used now to justify white anger is so completely disingenuous.
We have one question.
Can I speak now?
Yes.
All right, I just wanted to say.
Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, first of all, race sidetracks us, because what we're dealing with, race is a political construct. It has no basis in science whatsoever. Therefore, the problem at right now in this country, and has been historically, is the problem of the capitalist social order. It is designed, and it has to function as something that one class will oppress the other. Therefore, you divide those who are going to be oppressed up so that they are antagonistic to each other and never realize who the real antagonist is. That's what I wanted to say, that race is a sidetrack. Capitalism is the core, the fundamental contradiction that exists in our society.
Thank you. Since I think that was a comment, I suppose we can no. I think we want to save some time to have some signings, and so in that light, I will say thank you for a very enlightening conversation. Thank you for your contributions, and we will have a few minutes to sign books out in the lobby. Thank you.
It will.